Welcome, everyone. Let's start with a prayer, please. Teach us, O Lord, about your ancient paths. Help us to understand the good way and how to walk in it. Let the good news of your word bring rest for our souls. Amen. One correction from last week. I wanted to make sure this got on the recording. At the end of the lesson, I mentioned that there are 109 women in the five books that we were studying. And then I said 449 were named. That should have been 49. So I wanted to make sure you all hadn't thought I'd lost my mind. So last week, we covered the books of the law, the first five books of the Bible. This week, we're covering the books of history and prophecy. So we're just going to kind of mention the prophets. There's no way we can get into all of that in one week. If there ever was a good summary of biblical history, it's this George Santinet. Anybody know how to pronounce this guy's name? Shout it out. He's the one quoted, who we quote often, saying, "Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it." Often you see the word history, you know, but this is the actual quote. You can pretty much summarize biblical history as being a succession of people falling away into following the gods or idols of their neighbors, repenting and coming back to the God of Israel. So I want to quickly go over the handouts. The first one I want to look at is called the Old Testament Books in Chronological Order. I really like this because, and chronological means they're not listed in the order you're going to find them in your Bible or table of contents. But I like how it shows the judges, the prophets and where they fall within each of those books. Things to note is you see 1st and 2nd Chronicles down underneath Samuel and Kings. Think of that as like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. It's four different people telling the same stories from different perspectives. And so you have in the Gospels, some of them all tell the same story. Sometimes only a story is found in one of them. Well, 1st and 2nd Chronicles are telling some of the same stories that we find in Samuel and 1st and 2nd Kings. So that's why chronologically they're listed there together. A lot of the books we're going to study next week of what we call poetry or the writings are also occurring during the history period time that we're looking at now. So they're listed underneath. Ruth happens during the time of Judges. We're not going to cover her today. We're covering her next week. And also Esther happens after the exile. And we're going to cover her next week, just in interest of time, because I wanted to give extra time to those two. You note that Job happened really early on, most scholars believe, but because of the way it's written, it's considered poetic literature. So we'll be covering Job next week when we cover the poetry books too. And you remember that Leviticus and Deuteronomy are all about the law, so that's why they're listed underneath Exodus and Numbers, okay? All right. So let's see if we remember the five books we covered last week. The first book of the Bible is Genesis. Second is Exodus. The third is Leviticus, then Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Okay, now, if you were here last week, you remember that I said, if you take your Bible and hold it like this and find about the halfway mark and open it up, you're going to be right in Psalms or pretty close to Psalms, okay? If you take away the first five books of the Bible, everything else is what we're covering today. Okay? Now, I mentioned last week that the Old Testament has about 4,000 years of history. 2,000 years of that history is covered in the five books that we talked about last week. There's 1,600 years, roughly, in the history we're talking about this week. Okay? So I really do like this this handout. Now, on the back of that is the map of Canaan and the 12 tribes, and I'll get back to that in just a little bit, so hold that aside. The listing of judges and the kings. There are 15 judges in the book of Judges. We're not going to talk about all of them. Also be aware, though, that Moses is a judge. But because he's in the history books, he's usually not listed in the listing of judges. Below that are the three kings of the United Kingdom, after which the kingdom divided. We'll talk about that. And this handout shows the kings of Judah and the kings of Israel and the associated prophets and how long each of them reigned. Okay? So that's, we'll have a test on that next week. Make sure. Right. Okay, let's see what I didn't cover. We got that. So let's just jump right into Joshua. So now we are into your lesson handout for today. You got a little space after the names of each of the women that we're going to cover if you want to jot some extra notes in there, but the scripture references are there. It would be good if you would open your Bibles and follow along. So, Joshua's the next book right after the first five, so it's the sixth book in the Bible. And you remember last week, we talked about how Joshua was the one who took over after Moses died. Okay, so he's got a whole book. So, in Joshua, we learned about the two spies crossing the Jordan, the Battle of Jericho, the sun stands still, the conquest of the land. Conquest is really such a benign word for the bloody pillage and plunder that actually goes on. And we're going to talk about some of that. The division of the land among the tribes and Joshua's farewell address. So that's not everything in the book. Those are the highlights. So if I wanted to know something about Joshua, the book I would go to find out about him would be Joshua. If I wanted to find out something about the Exodus, the book I would go to would be if I wanted to find out something about, see if you remember last week, the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, I would go to Genesis. And Moses' life is pretty much also in Exodus, right? So just so you have the big ideas of where the big stories are in the Bible. So let's look at this handout about the division of the land among the tribes. So remember from last week, Jacob's name was changed to Israel. So Jacob, Yaakov, means trickster, where Yisrael, and remember last week I said anything with El in the name is something to do with God, means strives with God. And God gave him that name the night that they had the big argument. It was more than an argument, but they struggled all night long. And God changed Jacob's name to Israel. So we talk about the 12 tribes of Israel. We're talking mostly about his 12 sons, not just the 12 tribes that are associated with the land. The land of Israel is really the land of Jacob, but his name was changed. Remember also last week we talked about how Levi was and his descendants were not given a portion of land, and Joseph was not given a portion of land. So Joseph's two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, filled those two spots. So when you look at the 12 tribes, the names don't exactly coincide with the 12 sons of Jacob. Okay, everybody with me on that? So here's how they're divided. One thing I want you to notice is that Manasseh has some land over on the east side of the Jordan River, and Manasseh has some land over on the west side of the Jordan River. Y'all see that? The three tribes over here on the east side made an agreement that they would cross with everyone over into the promised land and fight to conquer the land with them. And then they went back over and settled in this area. So that's a little tidbit that you want to be aware of. In case you're into this sort of thing, the land of Israel is about 290 miles in length, about 85 miles across at the widest point. A few places to note. I want you to see where Mount Nebo is. And it is down here and where Reuben is. Do you see Mount Nebo in gold? Okay. That's where God took Moses up onto this mountain to look over into the promised land and where Moses supposedly died. Now I want you to find Mount Carmel. You see over here, way in the northeast, where Asher is, between the A and the S, you see Mount Carmel? That's where Elijah had his big contest with the prophets of Baal. You've heard about that story, I'm sure. I want you to also make note of where Benjamin is. So the very top of the Dead Sea down here to the left, that's where Benjamin's tribe is. You see Judah below that? It's a fairly large area. That's where Jerusalem and Bethlehem are. I want you to note where Shiloh and the Mount Gerizim is. So go up to Manasseh. I'm sorry. Ephraim and Manasseh. So you see the dividing line. Shiloh is just below that dividing line in Ephraim. And right above it is Mount Gerizim. Because we're going to be talking about that area as well. The Dead Sea is a salt sea. It's about 31 miles in length and 230 miles square in area. And it's about a little over 1,000 feet deep. It's the lowest point on dry land on the earth. It begins at 1,300 feet below sea level. The Sea of Galilee is a little sea above that. We're going to spend a lot of time with that when we get to the New Testament. It's about 13 miles in length and 64 miles square in area, and it goes to 141 feet. All right, so you can go back and reference that as you'd like. Now we're going to jump into some of the women in Joshua. I want to start with Rahab. She's right there at the beginning in Joshua chapter 2. We'll pretty much go in order, so once you're in the book, we'll just kind of flip forward. In Joshua chapter 2, verse 1, and a lot of people know this story, so I'm just going to point out some things. She's referred to as Zona. The word means unfaithful, but it's generally understood to mean prostitute. So now I want to have a little sidebar to discuss sex in the Bible. The Hebrew Bible uses two different words for prostitutes, Zona, or Zana, and Kedeshah. And the word Zona refers to an ordinary prostitute or a loose woman. The word Kedeshah literally means consecrated, and it refers to a cult or temple prostitute. And the foreign religions had those. Sex with another man's property is not allowed in the law. And we talked last week about the fact that wives and concubines and slaves and daughters are property. So there's a lot of laws about not having sex with those people if they don't belong to you. So to have sex with one of them, if you own them, would be contrary to the law. Otherwise, any man can have sex with their own property, so that's fine. Concubines are not owned by any man, nor are they obligated to procreate for lineage purposes, which is the only reason you have wives and concubines. Few laws in the Hebrew Bible govern prostitution, with two exceptions. A father is not allowed to turn his daughter into one, and priests are forbidden to marry them. There are no laws that disallow men to have sex with them, nor is it against the law to rape, rip open the pregnant bellies of, and otherwise brutalize foreign women during wars and conquests. There are some laws about the treatment of slave women. It could be interpreted that an Israelite woman not otherwise betrothed or married could be a prostitute. The law states, this is actually in the law, her wages cannot be used, however, for temple offerings. So an Israelite woman is also forbidden from being a religious prostitute, that other one we talked about. Josephus, a first century historian, reports that Rahab kept an inn. There's no mention if this was her only income. She could have had a brothel. Maybe she was like Miss Kitty at the Long Branch Saloon, like in Gunsmoke. Whether a brothel madam or not, saying that Rahab was a prostitute is about saying, like, she's not from around here. It had no negative connotation to those in the time who understood it. Since she's not an Israelite, being a prostitute would have had no legal or negative connotations. That was simply her job. No laws are being broken. Her house was in the wall of the city, and she hid the two spies when it became known that they were in the area. after escaping, the spies promised to spare Rahab. We know this part of her story. And so her family and she were all safe. And this is the Battle of Jericho we're talking about. So Rahab, and this part is in chapter 6, verses 17 through 25, where she's and her family are saved. Rahab and her whole family were not only saved, they were incorporated among the Hebrew people. She's listed in the chapter of the faithful in Hebrews 11 and in the genealogy of Jesus. She married Salmon of the tribe of Judah and was the mother of Boaz, who next week we'll learn was married to Ruth. So she was King David's great-great-grandmother. And that's the only one we're covering in Joshua. Let's skip over to Judges. And that's the next book. So the book of Judges covers the conquering of the land, more conquering and pillages and plunders, the succession of all the judges, the children of Israel falling away from God, going into idolatry. Of the 15 judges, the most well-known are the stories of Deborah, Gideon and his fleece, Jephthah and his rash vow, and Samson and his strength. Those are stories we learn usually as children. Well, and then there's Delilah. There's no central government at this time, but at times where important decisions needed to be made or problem solved, they would seek counsel of the judge. And as I mentioned, the same Hebrew word used for judge in the book of Judges is used for Moses, and so that's why we account him as a judge as well. And by the way, it's not a term like an office. It's a verb. They judged Israel is how it's always used. So we have a period of judges for about 300 years. And that period ended when we had the first king. The women I want to cover in Judges, the first is Deborah. She's in chapters 4 and 5. She's the only woman judge. She's also referred to as a prophet. She was a tribal leader, both military and legal. Chapter 5, often called the Song of Deborah, is perhaps the earliest sample of Hebrew poetry. She's considered a saint in the Catholic Church, which I didn't know. Let's look at chapter 4 and verse 5. It says, she would sit under the palm tree of Deborah, it was named after her, between Ramah and Bethel and the mountains of Ephraim, and the children of Israel came up to her for judgment. Barak was a military leader under her leadership, and he refuses to go into battle without her. She consents, but she warns him, if they have a victory, then it's going to be accounted to a woman. True to her prophecy, a battle is fought, led by Barak, and Sisera, who is a Canaanite leader under Jabin, king of Hazor, he's completely defeated, after which there's peace for 40 years. That's a long time for a woman to be in leadership. This is a story of a strong, powerful, wise, and influential woman. I especially like to think of her under the tree, people coming from all around to seek her wise counsel. Yael is in Judges, we're first introduced in Judges chapter 4, but her story is in chapter 5, verses 24 through 27. And Yael has that L in it, right? And it means, her name means goat or ibex. Literally in Hebrew now, it's their mountain goats are called ibexes. She was a Kenite woman, which is where Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, was from. So she lived a nomadic life. We learned about that last week. Now Sisera, running away from Barak and Deborah, he's on the run, and he comes to her tent, and she gives him hospitality. We'll put that in quotes. She hides him, and he was thirsty, so she gives him a jug of milk. Exhausted, he falls asleep, and while sleeping, she drives a tent peg into his temple. Now, I want to read, because this is hilarious, chapter 4, chapter 4, verse 21. Then Jael, we'll call her Jael, Yael's Heber's wife, took a tent peg and took a hammer in her hand and went softly to him and drove the peg into his temple. And it went down into the ground, for he was fast asleep and weary. So he died. In case we had any doubt. So Barak arrives. He was chasing after Sisera, and she shows him, verse 22, as he comes, Jael led him out to meet him and said to him, "Come, I'll show you the man whom you seek." And when he went into her tent, there lay Sisera, dead, with the peg in his temple. I just think it's funny the way it's written. The daughter of Jephthah is in Judges chapter 11. We've probably heard this story. Jephthah was a judge for 6 years. He led the Israelites in battle against Ammon and the Ammonites and made a vow to God that if God would just give him victory, he would sacrifice whatever appeared first coming out of his door and to greet him. So he regretted this vow. Let's look at chapter 11. And verse 35, this is where we find out he regretted that decision. And it came to pass when he saw her that he tore his clothes and said, "Alas, my daughter." Well, it was his daughter who came out. So his daughter asks him to give her 2 months to go to the mountain with her maids and bewail her virginity. So it's disputed whether or not she was actually sacrificed. It seems that if she were going to die, she would be bewailing her life instead of her virginity. I want to look in the same chapter, verse 39. And it says, "And it was so at the end of 2 months that she returned to her father, and he carried out his vow with her, which he'd vowed, and she knew no man." Why would it say that if he killed her? So, and human sacrifice is against the law. So what I think happened is that she was consecrated to God, kind of like Hannah consecrated Samuel. And in as part of that consecration, she was to remain a virgin all of her life, which makes sense now that she's bewailing her virginity and comes back. But it is a sacrifice to Jephthah in that he will never have any offspring to carry on the family name. In verse 34, we learn that she's his only child. And in that day and time, that's a huge sacrifice because your children are everything, carries on the name. Okay, so maybe a little different way of looking at that story. Samson's mother, we're introduced to in chapter 13. Her story is a lot like Hannah's, a barren woman looking for a child, and very much like Mary's story in that she's visited by an angel. And she's told here in 13, verse 3, "And the angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, 'Indeed, you are barren and have borne no children, but you shall conceive and bear a son.'" Does that sound a lot like the Mary story, doesn't it? Note that the angel only appears to her. Included in the promise is the instruction that the child is to fulfill a lifetime Nazirite vow. And when she tells her husband, he wants them both to pray for another angelic visitation so they can get further instructions. Her information is not good enough, I guess. Of interest is that the second visit is only to her. So initially, we see that in verses 8 and 9. But the angel sticks around and she brings her husband to the angel. And this is what we come to understand is an actual visit from God for reasons we don't have time to go into. The parents are told that their son will be a lifetime Nazirite. So I want to talk about what that means. To take a Nazirite vow for life is to be known as a Nazirite. That's not to be confused with a Nazarene, who is someone from the town of Nazareth. So they're two different things. A Nazirite vow is voluntary. It's described in Numbers chapter 6, verses 1 through 21. Nazirite comes from the Hebrew word meaning nazir, which means consecrated or separated. The vow was for women as well as for men, and it could be for a specific amount of time, days, weeks, or it could be for life. whatever the period of time, the requirements were that you abstain from grapes in any form, wine, vinegar, raisins, grapes, that you not do not cut the hair of your head, that and you do not become ritually impure by touching corpses or graves. Upon completion of the vow, there's a ritual cleansing, including the shaving of the head. Offerings are brought and the shaved hair is added to the offering. Of note, so that's a Nazirite, because their son is a Nazirite for life, and so understanding the requirements is important in understanding what happens with him. Hannah being barren, as we said last week, is a theme we're going to see over and over through many women's stories. If your only worth is to bear a progeny, then being barren is about the worst thing that can happen to you. So now I want to talk about Samson's Philistine wife, and we're in Judges chapter 14. It's important to know that while Samson is known for his superpower strength, he had an equally powerful temper. Both of his wives were Gentiles, Philistines. The one here in Judges 14 and 15 is associated with the story about the riddle. You know, when he was walking and he saw the corpse and the honey. Okay, so he gives this riddle and states that he'll give the men who are listening linen garments and changes of clothing if they can figure out. And so the story goes on and on with this woman wailing and trying to find the answer because the men want her to get the answer. And after 7 days of this, he relents and gives her the answer. And when he finds out, he gets upset. First, he says, chapter 14, verse 18. I'm in 13. 14, 18. Now, that's the riddle. Well, I've got the verse wrong here. But he gets really upset with the men, and in order to honor his debt, he goes out and kills 30 other men and gets their clothes to give to the men who solved the riddle. So some time passes. He's away in his anger. And upon his return, he learns that his wife's father, assuming that he's upset with her now and doesn't want her anymore, has given her away to his best man as wife. And you guessed it, his anger rages again. And so this is where we have the story of him taking the 300 foxes, tying their tails together, putting the torch in between, and the result is destroying all the grains and vineyards. Then we have a big uproar after that, a great slaughter, it says in chapter 15, verse 8. And that's the last we hear of this wife. His next wife is Delilah, and we pretty much know this story. It comes in Judges chapter 16, and she was his second wife, the only one of whom it says he loved her. She was responsible for breaking the Nazirite vow because she cut his hair. Remember, and not cutting the hair is one of the requirements. So when his hair is cut, the Spirit of God left him and he lost his powers. So because we know her story, we won't go into it. I just want to make sure you got that connection with the Nazirite vow. The concubine of Bethlehem is in Judges 19 and 20. And often this is a story that most people have not heard. So we'll flip over to chapter 19. I think it's one of the most horrible stories in the Bible. So first, let's understand the difference between a concubine and a wife. A free wife was a woman born to a free man. She was acquired, purchased, because she's property, by her father paying a bride price, and usually there was a wedding feast. A concubine was a slave wife. The woman was acquired as a slave, no ceremony. While both free and slave wives, or the concubines, were considered to be property of their husbands, a free wife held a greater place of social honor, and her children had inheritance rights that the concubine's children would not have. Sometimes there might be some special circumstances, but generally that was the case. So in this story, we have a Levite who gets a concubine from Bethlehem. Note in chapter 20, verse 4, he's referenced to her as her husband. So this was illegal. He's just not running around with a prostitute, okay? And nobody thinks anything strange about this situation. In 19:2, it says, "But his concubine played the harlot against him and went away from him to her father's house at Bethlehem in Judah and was there for 4 whole months. Now, this term played the harlot can mean she was just unfaithful. Like, unfaithful could have been, she didn't stay with him. She ran back home. All right? Because of the way that could be interpreted. Why did she go back home? Possibly she went back to her job, what she was doing when he acquired her. Possibly she was the only source of income for her family. We know from the same chapter, in verses 4-9, that her father detained them over and over and over again. There must have been a huge amount of love and bond between them. Was this a grieving father and a daughter who couldn't abide the separation? We don't know. At any rate, he goes back and fetches her and then is on his way to take her back home. And this is when the story gets ugly. On his way back home, they stop for the night in Gibeah in the town of Benjamin, the land of Benjamites. And I showed you on the map where that was, okay? So you have an idea in your head. And they accept the hospitality of, the Bible says, an old man they met in the town square. And then it begins to sound like the Sodom and Lot story. Men from the town beat on the door, insisting that the old man bring out his guest under the assumption that they want to have sex with him. The man begs them no, and then, as we've seen in other stories, he offers his own virgin daughter and the Levite's concubine instead. Here, take these women. They're, just property. Well, they won't have any of that. The Levite then just throws his concubine out the door. So let's read in chapter 19, starting at verse 24. Look, this is the Levite. Here's my 25. Ben would not heed him. So the man, the Levite, took his concubine and brought her to them. And they knew her and abused her all night until morning. And when the day began to break, they let her go. When the woman came as the day was dawning and fell down at the door of the man's house where her master was till it was light, when her master arose in the morning, opened the door of the house, went out to go on his way, there was his concubine fallen at the door of the house with her hands on the threshold. And he said to her, "Get up, let's be going." But there was no answer. So the man lifted her onto the donkey and the man got up and went to his place. No one's upset with the Levite. Oh, and what he does next then is he hacks her up into 18 pieces and sends her body out through the land. And no one's upset with the Levite for hacking up the woman's body nor throwing her out the door to be brutalized. They're upset as with the Benjamite's hospitality to the Levite. And this story really disturbs me. I can't contemplate what this woman went through. It reminded me of what happened in December of 2012 to a New Delhi, India woman, a young medical student who was brutalized on a bus. Her ordeal lasted 84 minutes, and this woman's ordeal lasted all night long. The book of Ruth comes right after, and it's a little 4-chapter book that we're going to cover next week. So if you're flipping along with me, you are now in 1 Samuel. 1 and 2 Samuel contain more wars and conquests. The story about Samuel, Samson and Delilah, Philistines taking the ark. The ark was where the Ten Commandments were contained, and it was the most holiest relic to the Israelites. And it was kept in the tabernacle in the holiest of holy place. It had the seraphim on top, and God's glory would come down upon this. So the Philistines have take the ark in these. Saul becomes king. We have the end of the judges. David's made king. Story of David and Goliath. Wars between David and Saul. David's life and all of his conquests. David dancing before the ark as he brings the ark back from the Philistines. David's plan for a temple. David and Bathsheba, their son Solomon. The story about Amnon and Tamar. And Absalom and conspiracies. That's pretty much the big stories in those two books. Contemporary prophets are Amos and Hosea. So first I want to talk about Hannah. Her story is right at the get-go in 1 Samuel chapter 1. Her story is fairly well known. She's one of the two wives of Elkanah. The other could have children, but Hannah was barren. Here we go again. As in other stories, this caused a contention between the two women, which was further problematic because Elkanah favored Hannah. Does this sound familiar? So I want to look at verse 3. This man, referring to Elkanah, went up from his city yearly to worship and sacrifice to the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. Also the two sons of Eli, the priests of the Lord, were there. So we looked on the map. We'll learn later about making sacrifices up on Mount Gerizim. And I showed you where Shiloh was in Ephraim. Okay? It's important that you are aware of this area because understanding the story of the woman at the well, which we'll talk about in a couple of weeks, is related to what's going on here. Before the split of the kingdom and the times of the judges, the tabernacle resided at Shiloh. So remember in the 40 years of wanderings, the tabernacle wandered around with them. But once they got into the promised land, conquered it, and settled, the tabernacle stayed in Shiloh. And worship was conducted on the nearby mountains. So by New Testament times, Samaritans, who actually are come from the area of Manasseh and Ephraim, Samaritans continued to believe that Mount Gerizim was the original holy place of Israel from the time that Joshua conquered Canaan. And the major issue between the Jews and the Samaritans was where was the place of worship to be. Mount Zion in Jerusalem, according to the Jewish faith, or Mount Gerizim, according to the Samaritan faith. And by the way, Samaritans still exist today, and their holy Bible is the first five books. So we have Eli and his entire family worshiping. In Old Testament times, to worship meant to go to the tabernacle or later to the temple and to burn something up. Often this involves a journey to get where the tabernacle or the temple is. And we just read that Eli's taken his family to worship, which explains why we now have Hannah sitting in the tabernacle praying and weeping bitterly to God for a child. The priest Eli thought she was drunk, and once he got the story straight, he told her that God would answer her prayer, and she has a child and names him Samuel. See that L in there? Shema, which means hears, El, God. His name means God hears. And she dedicates him to God, which means as a child he's given to the priest to raise, which is why she's going to visit him at the tabernacle. Samuel becomes one of the greatest prophets in the Bible, and there are two books given to him. So Michal, was one of David's eight wives. I'm going to check my time here. We're not going to finish everything today, I don't think.
That's okay.
So she was the youngest daughter of Saul. Saul quoted a bride price at 100 Philistine foreskins. Ever the overachiever, he bought her for 200 foreskins. She's best known for her poor attitude at David's dancing nearly naked in front of the ark, the subject of many a sermon about bitter wives or wives not supporting their husbands. And I'd like to take another look at her. We're told in 1 Samuel, we're going to skip all the way over to chapter 18, and verse 20, also in verse 28, that Michal loved David. We're never told if this was reciprocated. And one of the many rifts between David and Saul, she covers for him, hides him, pretending he's asleep in her bed with what's probably household gods to look like he was under the covers, and lets him down through a window. And although she risks her life for him, he never tries to contact her. He runs away, and when you work out the chronology or timeline of David's life, you realize that 8 to 10 years go by from the time he left Michal until he demands she be returned to him. In the interim, he amasses six other wives and has children. So after David runs away, Saul gives her as wife to Palti. Realizing they were married for at least 8 years, I'm going to look at 2 Samuel 3, and verses 15, 16. So we've skipped over 1 Samuel. We're in 2 Samuel. And Ish-bosheth sent and took her from her husband, from Palti, the son of Laish. Then her husband went along with her to Baruim, weeping behind her. So Abner said to him, "Go, return." And he returned. I think this is so, so very sad. Put yourself in Michael's shoes. How do you feel about David, the man whom you loved, whom you risked your life for, who abandoned you for 8 years, and now has separated you from the man who's been your husband for 8 years, whom obviously there's a love relationship going on? Now imagine looking out of your window at this same man, watching the public display of piety. What do you feel? The scripture says in Samuel 6:16 that she despised David. This means literally to think down, to disregard, to act as if whatever came before never existed. Like the phrase, "They are dead to me." She actually calls David out for his behavior in 2 Samuel 6:20. And I kind of see her doing this with a sarcastic voice. So I'm flipping over to chapter 6, verse 20. Then David returned to bless his household, and Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet David and said, "How glorious was the king of Israel today, uncovering himself in the eyes of the maids of his servants as one of the base fellows shamelessly uncovers himself." I've lost count of how many women I know who live with what appears to be a good Christian man, who sit in pews Sunday after Sunday, often holding leadership positions, saying prayers publicly, but at home they're abusive, hurtful, and demeaning. Michal knows what that's like. For people to not understand the sorrow and pain and emptiness and often abuse in which they live, and all the while never knowing what kind of person their husband really is. And I think we need to give her a break. Abigail, she is first introduced in 1 Samuel 25. She's one of David's 8 wives. Her story is interesting. She was married to a buffoon who insulted David. Because of her quick intelligence, she smooths things over, brings gifts, and offering profuse apologies. In her long speech that's in 1 Samuel 25, she offers up what some say is a prophecy over David. For this reason, she's named in some sources as one of 7 female prophets. Whatever the case, we get the impression that she's pretty intelligent. And David accepts her gifts, gives her a blessing, and she returns to her husband, who is now having a drunken party. She waits until the next morning when he's sober, and she tells what she's done, whereupon he has a heart attack and 20 days later dies. So this is how she, and David hears about it, was so impressed with her, takes her as a wife. Okay, I want to talk about Rizpah. Yeah, we have just enough time, and we'll start with Bathsheba tomorrow, next week. Rizpah's in 2 Samuel 3 and 7. She's first mentioned, but her story is in chapter 21. She was a concubine of Saul's. We know about that legal arrangement, and her story wrecks me. You'll need to review all the complicated political history, but the bottom line is that her 2 sons, along with 5 sons of Merib, were executed and hung on public display. For 5 to 7 months, she never leaves the side of the decaying bodies of her hanging sons, fighting off birds of prey and wild beasts. So let's look at 2 Samuel 21, verse 10. "Now Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, took sackcloth and spread it for herself on the rock from the beginning of harvest until the late rains poured on them." This is how we know it's a 5 to 7 month period of time. "And she did not allow the birds of the air to rest on them by day or the beasts of the field by night." I can't imagine watching the bodies of my children deteriorating over time. I can only imagine how living through such a thing might drive a person insane. Her actions move David, the king, and that impresses me. And he does something about it. He has their bones formally buried. So this little tiny verse about this woman and her actions influencing the king, but just contemplating her is doing that is quite powerful, I think. So we've got a few more women that I want to touch on. I think this might be a good place to stop. I might be able to get Bathsheba in. No, we only have 5 minutes till the next service. So we'll stop there for now and carry on next week. Bring all your handouts back.